So I had the sweet and sour chicken for lunch before the meeting, and you get a fortune cookie. And mine says, an unexpected event will soon bring you fortune. Huh. Well, I'd like to thank Randy for inviting me to this symposium. I actually met Randy, I knew it was sometime in the 80s, and he reminded me, it was 1987 or 1988 at a Soil Science Society of America sponsored field trip across much of the Mojave Desert. And I guess at that time, in addition to discussing soils, I guess I mentioned to you that I played volleyball. So when he invited me to this, he asked me if I was still playing volleyball. And I said, no, my knees are gone, my arms are gone, pretty much everything is gone. So I had to retire a few years ago from volleyball, and I've also had to retire from academia last July after 35 years. But although I can't play volleyball, I can still describe and sample and study soils. And so that's the good news. And I don't dig pits anymore in surfaces like this, but some of my younger former graduate students like Missy Epps here still do. And when you dig a pit below a desert pavement like that, what you'll see is something like this. Is from the slide from the classic Morbid Memories Soil Science Society of America slide set. You see what used to be called a red desert soil, now called a typical capwargid. And you see the typical kinds of varieties you see in desert soils. You see usually pretty nice but thin, reddened, and clay-enriched B horizon, perhaps an argillic horizon. You'd often below that, a horizon enriched, particularly in calcium carbonate. Very little A horizon development, just a pale horizon development, astonishingly called an E horizon. In the old days, although I was just in South Africa a few years ago, and they're still calling it an E horizon, which is wrong, but, well. In any case, 50 years ago, I took a class from the great Bill Dickinson at Stanford, and he presented in his lecture on weathering, which produces sediment and sedimentary rocks, gave us his handout, which pretty much stated how a lot of soil scientists at that time envisioned mechanisms of soil development in different landscapes, and of course they were lateralization, podzolization, and glycation, and these are forming in areas with abundant to heavy precipitation, but they save some room for desert soils, and they said, well, in those areas we get calcification. And that happens where there's what they call scant precipitation. And how are desert soils supposed to form? Well, in certain respects, they formed a lot like these wetter soils. You just didn't get as much hydrolysis, not as much chemical weathering. So you might chemically weather a little bit of feldspar, produce a little bit of calcium, a little bit of potassium. Some of that would end up interacting with water that was wicking up by capillary action, combining with calcium to form the zone of lime excess, and this is how calcification occurred, and that's what we were taught. All these soils back then, and still in many respects believed by many people today, formed according to the mode of profile development developed by the great Vasily Vasilievich Tokachev. In the 1880s, he presented a classic paper which proposed a general mode of soil profile development, starting with some sort of geologically determined paramaterial. Eventually, he recognized that on certain landscapes, you would eventually get a little A horizon, and over time, you get a more complex soil with many horizons, and he recognized that in certain stable landscapes, that this was time-dependent and that all the soil development take place below a stable surface, producing the classic ABC Tokachev canonical profile. Now, how would a desert pavement form if the soil beneath it was forming by a classical Tokachev-inspired soil profile development? Well, the idea was, and these were all the traditional models that you'll see as of well into the 1970s and still accepted by many geomorphologists today, what would happen is you'd start off with a gravelly, sandy material. The wind would blow, the water would run off the surface, carry away the fines. That would leave a desert lag as the surface was slowly lowered. And once pavement, essentially a pavement had developed, i.e. the lag, then the soil profile, according to the Dokachev model, was formed below it. A slight modification of this model was that perhaps you might also get B horizon development below the pavement, perhaps forming during a pass water climate, perhaps a full glacial climate. By shrink soil processes, some of the clasts in the B horizon would rise up and accentuate the evolving desert pavement. In the late 1950s, well into the 1970s, and continuing through the work of people like Dr. Curtis Munger, who's here today, Lee Guile and his colleagues demonstrated that there was a very different way by which calcium carbonate was accumulating in soils. And in a classic paper that's been cited probably 4 billion times, in 1966, Guile and his colleagues proposed that the origin of calcium carbonate was not by hydrolysis, chemical weathering, and formation of calcium carbonate, but instead that virtually all of the calcium was derived from dust. They knew this based on chronal sequence studies, and by the fact that a lot of their carbonate was accumulating in largely silicic materials, in which the calcium concentration was just simply too small to accommodate carbonate accumulation. They didn't do any mass balance work, but it didn't take a genius to realize you couldn't get a petrocalcic horizon there that Lee's looking at and talking about in a field trip I went on all those years ago from chemical weathering. And so they published this paper and gave us the classic time-dependent four-stage sequence, which was highlighted in a great paper by Dan Moos a few years ago, and a paper on dust and geological processes, where he shows you the great four-stage sequence, points out the significance of calcium accumulation as a function of dust, and since then, just a few lines of evidence have largely confirmed Guile's work, that a great deal, if not 99% or more, of the carbonates and also the salts of these soils are derived from entrapment and incorporation of dust and its subsequent precipitation in calcic horizons. Well, Steve Wells and me and several graduate students started working in the SEMA volcanic field in the Mojave Desert in around 1983, and we continued to work there well into the 1990s. And amongst our objectives, at least one of my objectives, was to try to understand the mechanisms of weathering and salt development on volcanic flow surfaces. And of course, my approach was pretty much informed by the approach, the chronosequence approach. My understanding of desert soils development was informed by the work of Guile, Holly, and of course, the Israelis and Australian soil scientists who've worked in desert regions long before I did. And back in those ancient times, here Steve and I and some of our students are looking at one of the surfaces on about a quarter of a million year old basalt flow in the SEMA volcanic field. And to our surprise, what we observed appeared to be a desert pavement. Now, why is this surprising? Well, if you look in the bottom right, you'll see what that flow surface used to be. It was a flow that was characterized by pohoihoi surface morphology. In other words, there was zero matrix presence to begin with. So there was no matrix to blow away and make a desert pavement. So curious people want to know how you would make a desert pavement in a situation like that. And I think we began to determine the answer when we started excavating pits, as you can see there again in the photo on the upper left. You see the pale material there. We started looking at that a little more carefully, and what we realized is the pale material contained a significant amount of silt and fine sand-sized quartz and feldspar, which are not present as phenocrysts in this particular aphanitic mafic basalt. We knew it had to come from somewhere else. Didn't take a genius to realize what the source was. The source had to be dust. We started looking at exposed flow surfaces elsewhere, and we found that dust accumulation was virtually ubiquitous in all the fractures we could find on Pohoihoi as well as A'a surfaces in this region. We started analyzing the interior fractures in subsurface basalts, and we found orthogenic minerals like celestite. And those of you who know the composition of this mineral, it cannot possibly be derived from alteration of a basaltic protolith. It has to be derived from external sources, the sulfate obviously being derived from, for example, salt-rich deposits in nearby playas upwind. So when you actually look at the soil below these desert pavements, what did we see? We saw a pale A horizon, which of course has come to be known or was known as the vesicular A horizon because of the prominence of very well-developed vesicular pores in that horizon. Below that, a nice transitional AB horizon, a BTK horizon, and below that, what we call the rubbly horizon, or sometimes if we had our graduate students dig deep enough, we would find bedrock. And what, of course, was fascinating to us is that there was, certainly in the upper part of the soil, there were no pavement, there were no basalt fragments. It was virtually devoid of coarse fragments. So how do these soils form? It became clear that a horizon that really had been overlooked by a lot of soil scientists and geomorphologists to date, to that point, that really probably the key horizon to understand or look at to understand the overall development of these soils is the so-called vesicular A horizon. And yes, I know B, it's not plinthite, but that's what we called it back in those days. And we recognize it turns out that the vesicular A horizon is actually essential to the overall origin and evolution of the pavement itself, but it's also critical to the development of the subjacent B horizons. And we recognized also, you look at the AV horizon, it's very clear it's almost entirely made of alien, altered alien dust. And through the work of myself, Steve Wells, one of Steve's students, Kirk Anderson, later Bob Graham and his students, and many others, we've pretty much elucidated how these horizons form through a variety of particle size, mineralogic, bulk composition, optical luminescence dating, and the like. These horizons start initially forming almost immediately below coarse materials, and eventually they begin to coalesce, and as they continue to form and form a more or less continuous blanket of material below the incipient pavement, they also increase their clay content, and begins to increase as the water holding capacity increases and the diminished permeability, diminished hydraulic conductivity, and you start to accumulate clay. The clay is a significant, predominant component is smectite. You start generating a higher magnitude of shrink swell cycles, and you develop that beautiful polygonal network you see there. And that polygonal network turns out to be one of the keys to basically an evolving, essentially fracture hydrology system. It begins to become conduits for increased transfer of solids and dissolved materials and suspended materials, both not only into the AV but through the AV into subjacent horizons. It's a pretty remarkable horizon that really gone unnoticed for many decades. So if you start looking at it very carefully, you see that first stage of incipient development of the vesicular A, and you see its continuing growth. And then after the crack system evolves, you see now that a great deal of mass can actually be transferred below it as penetratively altered dust. And so the consequence of this is the emergence of an increasingly thicker and thicker soil devoid of clasts. And this is a so-called upward growth model of desert pavement, or as Steve and I used to joke, we called it the born at the surface model. So what we're saying here is that the pavement absolutely does not form by diffusion. It was there to start with, and it just emerges as soil development occurs actually beneath the pavement, and the pavement rises, leaving an increasingly thick clast-free zone. So what are the implications for the origins of pavements on the far more extensive surfaces in deserts, surfaces of alluvial fans, surfaces of fluvial terraces? Well, we would argue they form in virtually the same way. There you see a small pit on a desert pavement that's formed an alluvial deposit of about 70,000 years old, and we would argue that it forms in an identical way to those we saw on volcanic pavements. For example, one of my former students, Eric McDonald, is now prominent earth scientist at DRI. He's conducted a great deal of studies of soil chronal sequences in the Yuma region of southwestern Arizona. And here you see one of the soils he's looked at on 150,000-year-old surface. Its characteristics in terms of the pavement in the subsurface, A, B horizon, B horizons, both clay-enriched and carbonate-enriched and salt-enriched horizons, almost identical to what we see in the SEMA volcanic flows of similar age, with virtually all the fines, the silts, the clays, the salts, the carbonates derived from incorporated and pedogenically altered dust. So, in my opinion, what we need to think of when we look at soil development, at least in these circumstances, it's not forming via the Dokachev model. And I call it the accretionary and inflationary profile development model, and I call it that because clearly we have accretion going on, but what accommodates continued accretion is soil inflation. Soil inflation is accommodated by the development of a crack network, expansion and accommodation of addition of mass to the soil, and you get the slow upward growth of the soil, which seems counterintuitive. I guarantee you in the first seven or eight field trips we ran to this area and explained this, I guarantee you nobody believed it. People started believing it when we started applying cosmogenic surface age dating to the pavement and OSL dating of the subsurface soil to show we were right. So the pavement, the rocky pavement, actually plays a very important role in the entrapment of the dust. Ron Gerson and his colleagues recognized this as well back in the 1980s and published some very important papers showing how an evolving pavement would entrap dust. One of the things you observe when you look at evolving pavements on Piedmont surfaces, if you look at the left-hand side, you see a very recent Holocene fan deposit with coarse angular gravelly materials of classic barn soil topography. On the right, just a couple meters away, you see what a 35,000-year-old surface looks like. You now have evolution of a pavement from that initially boulder and swale-dominated material. And what you clearly see is shown on the corner, left-hand corner, you see that there's been a significant diminution of class sizes on that. And we know that plays an important role, ultimately, in continuing to entrap dust and also to actually start excluding a significant number of vascular plants on the pavement. So we wondered, how does that happen? And all the textbooks say, it's all salt weathering. Okay? Well, I wondered about that because a lot of these soils actually have no salts in the A horizon, the transitional AB. So it didn't seem reasonable to me. And so for years and years, I tell all my students in classes, I don't think it's soil weathering, and everybody tells me it can't be solar weathering. Well, I started thinking that it might be and proposed a hypothesis that non-uniform solar insulation could cause the development of fractures through thermomechanical stresses that arise from diurnal insulation. And so Missy Epps and I started looking at cracks in hundreds of rocks, and we found that when you look at those crack orientations and you apply circular statistical analyses to them, they're statistically strongly oriented. And the only way you really can explain that is at least to a large extent by, we would argue, solar insulation. And we started looking at crack populations elsewhere in the Mojave Desert, Australian deserts, the Gobi Desert, and now Missy continues to study this process and try to develop numerical models, better models, to try to understand exactly how this process works. But there's no question that the whole way we envisioned pavements to form was also wrong. So can we apply the lessons we've learned through the study of soil development through chronal sequence studies, looking, for example, at desert pavements, etc., to ostensibly geomorphically far less stable surfaces, that is, the geomorphic surface associated with mountainous or hilly landscapes such as these. Now, most geology textbooks, geomorphology textbooks, when you read them, they'll say, well, we expect rocky surfaces because the chemical weathering is limited by the sparse vegetation, scant rainfall, rapid erosion, and hill slope retreat. So we don't expect well-developed soils. We expect instead of these rocky, steep surfaces. And to a large extent, I think our thoughts on that were informed, or at least biased, by the work of the great geoscientist G.K. Gilbert. In a couple grueling seasons in the Henry Mountains of south-central Utah, when he had to travel there by literally by donkey or horse. After several seasons, he published several seminal papers, and one of these papers proposed that there were two fundamental types of hill slopes, and he recognized these two fundamental types of hill slopes as being present in the lower, more arid parts of the range, and in the more humid, temperate, cooler parts of the range. At higher altitudes, same rock type, volcanic rocks, but what he recognized is those lower slopes, you ended up with bedrock dominated, what he called detachment limited slopes. There wasn't enough weathering, not enough rainfall, not enough freeze-thaw to generate much of a mantle, and so ultimately you would end up with exposed bedrock and the rate of retreat would be limited by detachment processes, whereas the upper altitudes will be soil mantled. You'd have enough weathering, enough mainly mechanical weathering is what he thought was in those days, and that will give you transport limited slopes where you have a continuous carpet of vegetation mainly moving by creep. Now, in models, in papers, a series of very important and seminal papers published in the mid-1990s by Bill Dietrich, Arjun Heimsath, and their colleagues, they actually have proposed an excellent model called the soil production steady state model for these, the development and behavior of these transport-limited slopes. And it's been applied successfully in a number of temperate ranges, such as, for example, in Northern California, in the Oregon Coast ranges, and elsewhere. And for those of you who don't know how this model works, imagine a soil forming in bedrock via the Dokachev model. Now imagine it on a slope, okay? And so we begin to weather, we begin to chemically weather the saprolite, the bedrock to saprolite, slightly reducing its shear strength. And you take that material and you physically weather that, bioturbate it, and that forms the soil. And that's called soil production. You've lowered the shear strength of this material. You've colonized it with vascular plants. And so the principal mechanism by which this material moves would be by processes of abiotic and biotic creep. More or less analogous to diffusive transport. When the soil production is balanced by downslope movement, the soil thickness at a given point in the slope would stay the same. This will be referred to as a steady state system. You can derive from this relatively easily a differential equation and various ways of looking at that equation could allow you, for example, to determine how soil thickness should change as a function, for example, the second derivative of curvature. Well, okay, let's return to deserts. You would think that given the way transport-limited slopes are supposed to form, dominated by weathering, that you wouldn't see many transport-limited slopes in deserts, but you see actually a fair number of them. Here's some beautiful soil, mantled, vegetation-mantled slopes in the eastern Mojave Desert that my colleague Joe McAuliffe and I and Lyman Persico are looking at right now. Here's some transport-limited slopes you see in the foothills of the Sandia Mountains, semi-arid region just near my home in Albuquerque. Now, in the foreground, you see the typical landform or hill slope landform in the Sandias, which is a porstone topography. This is a typical type of topography formed in the Proterozoic granitoid rocks, the Sandia granite, characterized by very limited soil development, very patchy soils. But here and there, you see these beautiful transport-limited slopes with soil mantles, vegetation mantles, and so why are they forming in this environment? Well, if you look more carefully at these slopes, what you'll observe is that the slopes are actually mantled by aplite colluvium. Aplite is, for those of you who don't know what it is, it's the aphanitic version of silicic or leucocratic granitoid rocks. And it weathers quite differently than granite. It weathers to large fragments or blocks. And even though most of the slope is associated with granite, the upper part of its aplite, it's weathering to form colluvium, which mantles the entire slope below it. And if you look at the soils on, say, the back slope over the granite, what you see is an aplite, literally a pavement, and below that, you see these remarkably thick soils with argillic horizons almost 2 meters thick, a calcic horizon below that. They're incredibly thick soils, incredibly reddened, incredibly clay-rich. And when you look at the particle size distribution of these soils, you see they're significant increases in silt and clay. If you look at the micromorphology of the soils, if you look at the mineralogy, if you look at the bulk composition, it becomes clear what the source of virtually all of that plasma is. It's dust. And so we argue that these soils are not forming by soil production, sensu stricto. They're forming by entrapment of dust below a pavement where that pavement exists, that colluvial surface layer exists because of rock type differences. Now, if you look on the Colorado Plateau, if you look in the left-hand corner, you'll see the typical expression of slopes in sandstones, or for that matter, sometimes limestones or basalts. You'll see the detachment-limited steep cliffs that G.K. Gilbert would have predicted way back 150 years ago. But here and there, in the same precise formations, for example, in Jurassic sandstones such as the Morrison sandstone, or the Morrison Formation, or the Bluff Sandstone, you'll see these beautiful soil-mantled, vegetation-mantled, curvilinear, transport-limited slopes. How are they forming? Well, if you look carefully at the soil mantle, what you see below, particularly the inner canopy grasses and herbaceous shrubs, you see an A, a C horizon, and an R, not very thick, but you definitely see development of a thin, continuous soil mantle. And our studies of the sandstone show why it's forming. It's forming by physical weathering, principally thrink shell weathering of the cement for these sandstones, which is not calcite or silica, it's clay, which has a dominant smectite component. And that smectite is conducive to very rapid weathering and breakdown of this material and forming these steep or these thin soils, which can then be recruited by vascular plants, including pinyon. Now, if you look at a topo sequence on these slopes, you see that the soils never become really well developed. You see AC profiles, really don't see the development much of a B, if any B horizon exists at all. They do become increasingly thicker as you move down. You see accumulation material behind large trees with very curved trunks. This is all indicative of a carpet of soil that is mainly moving by creep. And as far as we can tell, it looks like a system that is very nicely described by soil production. Except when you look at slope aspect. So in the background, you see a transport-limited slope with a nice pinyon vegetation community. But in the foreground, you see the same exact rock, the identical rock, but with more of a southerly-facing aspect. And you see there not a transport-limited slope, but a detachment-limited steep cliff. What's going on here? Well, it's pretty darn clear that it's completely related to aspect. So here is a remarkable map that one of my graduate students completed and we published recently in Gulf of Law 2014. And what you see is a LIDAR-based map with sub-centimeter scale resolution where she actually mapped in detail the distribution of soil thicknesses across a basin that exposes a continuum of slopes with aspects ranging from north to the south. And what you see is a dispersion of the mesoscale forms from a very smooth form to very dispersed cliffs, whatnot. You see what you're looking at is the transformation of those north-facing mesic slopes to the south-facing steep slopes. And it's going on in the lifetime of plants that are growing in the regions between the north and south-facing slopes. In the ecotonal regions where you have steep environmental gradients, that's where these soils are, and surfaces and plant communities are undergoing transformation. Now here's my colleague, Joe McAuliffe, and one of our students studying in the ecotonal region, a slope. You can see the transformation going on. You can see the weathering and removal of the rapid removal of the soil with cliff rows occupying the remnant patches. You see the emerging calcite concretions, which will turn in. These are what I call emergent stage hoodoos. And this transformation, we believe, has been going on during the Holocene. We think it's being accelerated by global warming with increased intensity and period and frequency of drought. So finally, I would argue that through the kinds of chronosequence studies that were conducted in the desert, a project and the chronosequence approach grounded in the infamous Clorped equation of Hans Jenny have really played a similar role in helping us understand landforms such as desert pavements. I would also argue that that approach can also be used to study the evolution of hill slopes in desert regions as they are subject to climate change ranging from interglacial to glacial or those millennial or submillennial scale variations that are occurring during the Holocene. And so I think that although it's an old approach, it's a conceptual framework which still has a lot of power and can be used to test the results of newer, more modern models such as soil production. But I would say that we owe a lot to the legacy of Hans Jenny, one of the great earth scientists of the 20th century. Thank you.
Thanks, Les. We have time for one question for Les before he goes back to Albuquerque. Don't miss your chance.
Quick question. So about the sorting on the desert pavement, do you think that there's also something about like the half width of the desiccation crack kind of just mechanically sorting the size of the rocks that are going right?
Yes, that's definitely going on. You could actually, where you have larger scale crack networks, and you can back then, in the ancient times, we didn't have that, but more recently we can actually start to see the same kinds of sorting you see, for example, in Arctic terrains. So yes, there's definitely more to it than what we were posing, back in the Paleolithic. But science goes on and continues, and I get to watch in my dotage. So.
All right, thanks again, Les.